One of the reasons that we print our UU principles and sources each week on the back of the order of service is that newcomers often say that it is our principles and sources that were one of their first indications that a UU congregation might at long last be a spiritual home for them. And part of what makes our principles welcoming to a wide diversity of people is that they are intentionally not meant to be a creed, and they're not meant to be a test of faith. Rather, they are intended as ethical aspirations that of how we seek to treat one another amidst our diversity, as well as how we seek to work together to build a more just, equitable, and compassionate world. Our principles and sources were also not written in stone. Indeed, we explored last week how our sixth source of earth-centered traditions was added in 1995. Similarly, the original six UU principles passed during that 1961 consolidation of the Unitarians and the Universalists were revised in 1985 to make them more inclusive, most specifically to make them less sexist. You know, to go from the Mad Men era through second wave feminism, right, into the 80s. So the dignity of man, for instance, was changed to the dignity of every person. And the ideals of brotherhood were changed to the goal of world community. The most substantive change was the addition of a seventh principle, respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. So as important as that first principle is, you know, that's deeply grounded coming out of World War II, of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, of the inherent worth and dignity of every person, there was this growing realization that it wasn't just about affirming the integrity of individuals, but also about how we collectively are together with one another. And it is our seventh principle which is inspiring a small but growing movement within Unitarian Universalism to ask if our principles, which 30 years ago were revised to become less male-centric, might need now, especially in the wake and in light of global climate change, need to become less human-centric. The First Principle Project proposes that our support for the inherent worth and dignity of every person might it be expanded to recognize the inherent worth and dignity of every being. I've likewise seen a proposal to expand our second principle, justice, equity, and compassion in human relations, to be justice, equity, and compassion in all relations. We are human beings. And I hear this proposal as a challenge to expand our circle of care, compassion, and connection to other beings on this planet who also experience forms of sentience, forms of subjectivity. In last year's Earth Day service, we explored some of the impact of our human population septupling, increasing sevenfold in just two centuries, from around 1 billion human beings on this planet in 1800 to more than 7 billion in today. The resulting environmental impact of our species is jeopardizing the entire planet's future and climate. We were not always aware of our species' potential to have a cataclysmic effect on the interdependent web of all existence. As Elizabeth Colbert has written about in her Pulitzer Prize-winning book, The Sixth Extinction, prior to fossil discoveries in the 1700s, we humans didn't know that any species had ever become extinct. But since then, we have come to learn that there have been five great mass extinctions during the history of life on this planet. The first took place some 450 million years ago, when living things were still mainly confined to the water. The most devastating took place at the end of the Permian period, some 250 million years ago, and it came perilously close to emptying out the Earth altogether. The most recent and famous mass extinction came at the end of the Cretaceous period. It wiped out, in addition to the dinosaurs, the plesiosaurs, the mesosaurs, the ammonites, and the pterosaurs. Regarding the interdependent web of all existence and climate change, Colbert writes, "In pushing other species to extinction, humanity is busy sawing off the limb on which it perches, and increasing the likelihood of a potential sixth mass extinction on this planet." Here in the early 21st century, it is vital that we be honest about what it means to be heirs to the paradigm-shifting discoveries of Copernicus, Darwin, Einstein, Hubble, and so many others. I invite you to consider that minimally that means at least two things. First, it means that we humans are much less singularly significant than it was once reasonable to maintain. Our species has been wrestling for almost 500 years with a growing awareness that we are not the center of the universe. Rather, we are inhabitants of one far-flung planet on the edge of one galaxy that is merely one of more than 100 billion, not solar systems, but more than 100 billion galaxies in the universe. Second, it means that other beings on this planet are much more significant than was once reasonable to grant, both intrinsically significant to themselves as well as extrinsically significant to us, since our survival as a species depends on the continued flourishing of diverse interdependent ecosystems that comprise this planet's biosphere. From this perspective, we can perhaps begin to more fully appreciate the call just to consider changing our principles from every person to every being, and human relations to all relations. The goal is increasingly to shift our sense of ourselves from the one best species who could and should do whatever it wants without consequence to this planet and to other species, to a more realistic sense of ourselves as one among many beings who were inextricably woven together in an interdependent web. The person who has most helped me in thinking through how we might make such a shift with a maximum amount of integrity and compassion is the philosopher Peter Singer, who is a professor of bioethics at Princeton University. Singer is almost certainly the best known and most widely read of contemporary philosophers, which is to risk damning him with faint praise. Philosophers are not widely read. But he may also be one of the most influential of contemporary philosophers. His 1975 book, Animal Liberation, has been translated into 13 languages and has sold more than 500,000 copies. That being said, Singer himself admits that when I wrote Animal Liberation, I really thought that book would change the world and soon. "I know it sounds a little grand now," he writes, "but at the time, the 60s still existed for us. It looked as if real changes were possible, and I let myself believe that this might be one of them. All you have to do, though, is walk around the corner to McDonald's to see how successful I have been and to see how many corners McDonald's is around." There are some parallels in our own UU movement, which also was founded in those hope-filled 1960s. However, Singer's lament about factory farming and the fast food industry that I just quoted is from back in an interview in 1999. I just saw this past week that McDonald's is beginning a decade-long plan to use only cage-free eggs, you know, ethical Egg McMuffins or something like it, in the wake of its other recent announcement that it's moving away from using chicken treated with antibiotics. So sometimes it's not clear that they're actually using chicken, but that's a separate discussion. And while McDonald's is a long way from getting the Michael Pollan Food Justice Seal of Approval, when food giants make a shift in the right direction, there are real tangible ripples that go out in the right direction across the whole industry. For those not familiar with Michael Pollan, he's been a tremendous advocate, again, for food justice. And he doesn't actually say that you need to eat no meat, it's just that we probably need to eat a lot less to be sustainable, and that his three rules for food justice and working toward that are to eat real food, and by real food he means food that your grandparents and great-grandparents would have recognized as food, right? So eat real food, not much, mostly plants. Real food, not much, mostly plants, and you'll be headed in the right direction. To give you an overview of how Peter Singer thinks we might become less human-centric and more inclusive of all beings who can experience suffering, the following are four of his central convictions. The first is that pain is bad. And some very controversial. Pain is bad, and a similar amount of pain is equally bad, no matter whose pain it might be. By pain here, he includes suffering and distress of all kinds. This does not mean that pain is the only thing that is bad, or that inflicting pain is always wrong. Sometimes it may be necessary to inflict pain and suffering on others. Think of surgery, because it will lead to less suffering in the long term. His second point is that humans are not the only beings capable of feeling pain or of experiencing suffering. I think any of us that have pets are quite aware of that. Of course, the nature of beings will affect how much pain they suffer in any given situation. That's why, for instance, you can lock your dog in the kitchen and go away for 8 hours, but you can't do that to a baby, right? It's a spectrum. And here it may be helpful to say that there's a lot of specifics we could unpack, but in general, it's helpful to keep in mind, if your mind is leaping to extreme scenarios, that just because we as UUs are often pluralists and saying that there are multiple things that need to be kept in mind does not mean we're relativists, does not mean that we're saying anything goes. There's more to be said about that, but that's a starting point. Singer's third point is that when we consider how serious it is to take life, we should look not only at the race or sex or species to which that being belongs, but at the characteristics of the individual being killed, for example, its own desire about continuing to live or the kind of life it's capable of living. And the fourth and final one is that we are responsible not only for what we do, but also for what we could have prevented. For any of you who grow up Roman Catholic, you may remember this as sins of omission and sins of commission, right? You're responsible not only for what you do, but also for what you fail to do, that you could have done. Singer writes, we may never kill a stranger, but if we know that our intervention will save the lives of many strangers in a distant country, yet do nothing, think of the refugee crisis. Consider, for example, the fact that the sum that buys us a meal in a fine restaurant would be enough to provide basic health care to several children who might otherwise die of easily preventable diseases. What do we do with that knowledge? If you're interested in going deeper into the specifics of these issues, I'll be leading a 6-week class here at UUCF titled, What Does It Mean to Live Ethically? It'll be on Tuesday evenings starting at 7 p.m. for the next 6 weeks, starting this Tuesday, September 15th. It's based on the third edition of Peter Singer's book, Practical Ethics, which has been the classic introduction to applied ethics for 30 years. If you have the time and interest, you're welcome to read the relevant parts of that book prior to each class session. In that case, the reading assignments are posted on the class webpage. So if you go to frederickuu.org/Peter Singer, it's in your order of service. You'll see the page numbers. But you're welcome to attend the class regardless of whether you have time to read the book. At the beginning of each session, I'll outline the basic frameworks of the arguments for that day's focus. Over the 6 sessions, we'll be exploring topics such as, is it ethical to buy luxuries? That is, think of like Maslow's hierarchy, things that you don't need, that aren't essential to your basic survival. Is it ethical to buy luxuries when others don't even have enough to eat? Should we buy meat from intensively reared animals? Am I doing something wrong if my carbon footprint is above the global average? Equality and discrimination. Is it ever okay to discriminate on the grounds of race and sex? Abortion, the use of embryos for research and euthanasia. And finally, political violence and terrorism. Are they ever justifiable? Think of, for example, to free enslaved people or for, climate change. You can think of eco-terrorists. So we'll be wrestling with that. Then in mid-November, we'll have a sequel to this morning's service in which we'll reflect further on wrestling with Peter Singer's ethics, as well as hear brief presentations from participants in that Tuesday night class who will be invited to share about how they might see the world differently as a result of the class or how they might be led to live differently. If you're interested, I invite you to join us on Tuesday evenings, and you're welcome to come to however many or few of the sessions as your schedule allows. In the meantime, allow me to put just a few more items on the table. Some critics say that Singer, as well as other supporters of any form of, for example, legalized euthanasia, risk that slippery slope down to Nazi science, an accusation that often fails to account for Singer being well aware of his own family's history as the child of Jewish parents who fled their native Austria in the late 1930s. There's also the perennial question of whether or not and to what extent Singer is able to follow the implications of his own logic. He did not, for example, kill his own mother, who had advanced Alzheimer's disease and whose care was consuming money that some of his critics say could have been more profitably spent elsewhere, according to his own ethical writings. But Singer has never said he is perfect. Rather, his challenge, both to himself and others, is to continually live into a more ethical way of life. And he has for many years, for instance, given away more than 20% of his income to the organizations that have the best track record, that have been proven to do the most good for the world's poor, an approach that he calls effective altruism. If you're interested in that, he's got a really pretty incredible and compelling TED Talks. If you Google Peter Singer TED Talk effective altruism, that's worth 20 minutes of your time. My title for the sermon this morning borrows from an anthology of Singer's essays titled Unsanctifying Human Life. What I take him to mean is that it is no longer reasonable to maintain the ancient religious worldview that all human life is unquestionably sacred and inviolable from womb to tomb. Instead, for more than 150 years, our species has been wrestling with Darwin's discovery that we are not, you know, created from on high and descended and made a little lower than the angels and everything else made for our use. Instead, we are just a little higher than the apes and deeply interconnected with this interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part. There's a lot more to say, and again, we'll be exploring in some more depth on the next six Tuesday evenings, as well as in that sermon in mid-November. There's also the longer-term question of whether this congregation feels led to become a sponsor in the First Principle Project. We would have to decide that and discern that democratically. That First Principle Project advocating to change our first principle from every person to every being, and or changing our second principle, human relations, to all relations. Any such change in the UU bylaws requires at least 15 sponsoring congregations as a first step, and the latest update I've heard is there are about 8 right now. But the First Principle Project has just gotten started. They just presented their first workshop at June at General Assembly in Portland. And to clarify, at this point, what we or any other UU congregation would be voting to sponsor is not whether to make the change, but it's rather to trigger a process that happens with any bylaw change, which is that do we want to start a 2-year conversation in the whole UU movement about whether this is something we might want to do and what phrasing we might want to use. For now, I'll conclude with the closing part of what's known as a Buddhist metta-meditation, M-E-T-T-A, which means loving kindness. It's a meditation that seeks to open our hearts and expand our compassion in ever-expanding concentric circles, starting with ourselves at the center, compassion for ourselves, and then expanding that offer of loving kindness to other human beings, and then finally expanding that offer of loving kindness to all beings who have some semblance of sentience, some semblance of subjectivity, who can experience suffering. May all beings be filled with loving kindness. May all beings be well. May all beings be peaceful and at ease. May all beings awaken to their true nature. May all beings be free. In the spirit of respect for the interdependent web of all existence of which we are a part, and with an increased existential awareness of our place as just one among many species on this far-flung but beautiful, precious, and at least for now, life-sustaining planet we call Earth, I invite you to rise and embody your spirit as we sing together in your teal hymnal, hymn 1064, Blue Boat Home. One of the lyrics from that song, As Tranquil Streams, the hymn that we sang after Water Communion, is that we as a movement revere the past but trust the dawning future more. And that Peter Mayer song that we sang, Blue Boat Home, is a lovely example of that. Some of you may have, he arranged that tune, but the actual tune is Heiferdahl, which some of you may have heard in your head, you know. If you grew up in a tradition, that's a very ancient hymn tune that many different songs, many involving Jesus, have been written. But what a great example, I think, of how we seek to draw wisdom from the past but balance it with modern insight. So let's keep that hymn tune, but what happens when we write some really powerful and moving new lyrics to it so that we revere the past but trust the dawning future more. So as you prepare to go from this place, continue your journey walking in love. Care for one another and care for this one earth. Do justice and make peace. And know that whatever taste or touch you've had in this time and place of hope, of love, of peace, or joy, that goes with you into the world. We're different for having spent this time together. So live boldly and with thanksgiving. Go in peace.